Greetings, and this welcome to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is Reverend Juliet Nightingale. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests for both experiences and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. You're more than welcome to call in and make comments and ask questions during the show, and we do welcome you to do that. Also, we'd like to encourage you to make a donation and help support this show and our organization, Toward the Light. For more information, please visit our websites, towardthelight.org. and towardthelight.info. This week I'm very pleased and honored to have as a special guest a physician in the Netherlands who's been doing tremendous work in the realm of near-death experiences and consciousness studies. Let us welcome to Toward the Light, Dr. Pim van Lommel. Dr. Lommel, hello, are you there? Hello, Dr. Lommel, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello, how are you? Welcome to Toward the Light.
Okay.
It's very good to have you with us this evening. And I'm very, very deeply moved by all of the work that you have been doing in the realm of near-death experiences and consciousness studies. And I wanted to ask you first off, what got you into the study of near-death experiences and consciousness? What brought you into that?
Because I'm a cardiologist, so I come in contact with patients who survive a cardiac arrest. And the first time I ever heard about a near-death experience was the time that the term didn't exist at all. It was in 1969, a patient was resuscitated, successful, and he was very, very disappointed that he came back. And he told me something about light and the tunnel and music. But I almost forgot it until I read the book by George Ritchie, Return from Tomorrow, in 86.
Yes.
And then that was the reason I started to ask my patients in our patient clinic who had ever been successfully resuscitated from a cardiac arrest to ask them if they could remember something from the period of cardiac arrest. And to my surprise, in 2 years, I had, out of 50 patients, I had 12 patients who told me about their near-death experience. And this was a kind of pilot study, and this was the reason we started in 88 our prospective study in 10 Dutch hospitals. And then we interviewed about 344 patients who survived a cardiac arrest in 4 years' time. And now that we did a long-term follow-up with interviews after 2 years and 8 years, asking patients if they have been changed. Of course, we wanted to know if the transformation you hear from near-death experiences, if it is due to the cardiac arrest or due to the NDE. So this was the reason why we started.
Well, that's very interesting. So the first encounter you had was back in 1969, you said, correct?
Yes, it's correct.
Now, did he volunteer this information to you? Well, I guess he would have if he just came out and said, disappointed to be back. And then you asked him what happened that caused him to be disappointed, I gather.
Exactly. So he told us. And I always say I never forget this story, but I never did anything with it until I was reading the book by George Ritchie.
Yes.
So that was really the reason to start. And then I also remembered the story of 69. So I always say to myself, I wasn't open enough to ask and to hear those stories.
Okay, and so it was in a period of time that you started becoming a lot more interested in this, realizing that there had to be something to this.
Yes.
After talking to all of these people, and I think you're right that the when people undergo cardiac arrest, they're certainly more likely to have a near-death experience and to, you know, really come back wanting to discuss this, although I know a lot of people, including myself, have been very shy about it. And something else that you mentioned in your article about the... it's called About the Continuity of Our Consciousness, and actually
yes.
I've had this article on my website, towardthelight.org, for quite some time. In fact, you sent it to me quite a long time back.
Yes.
And I said, this is excellent. So I've put it on my website. It's under near-death studies for anybody who wants to read this article. It's really tremendous, and I'm excited about this. Because one thing that you also mentioned that's of particular interest to me is you also address people in coma. And when I had my transcendent near-death experience in the mid-70s, I was in coma for 6 weeks from cancer. And flatlined on my birthday, and was actually in communion with another comatose patient, and then I had all these other experiences. So I'd love to get some of, you know, your comments and finding about that as well, about, you know, not only cardiac arrest patients, your input about that, but also about people in comatose.
Yes. Well, we did our study in patients who had been in coma, or what we could call clinical death, due to cardiac arrest. This was the subject of our study, prospective study, because we want to have a very clear medical, critical medical situation where we know that the brain stops functioning within 15 seconds. But I have talked to many, many patients who had experienced an NDE during coma, or even I had, you know, someone who had been declared brain death by his neurologist, and family just refused to give permission for organ donation, and then the patient came by after 3 weeks. So I know those stories, yes.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about that patient? And because it's very interesting to me when you know, people in the medical establishment will be certain that somebody is not going to come back, is not going to survive, is they're irreversibly in coma and what have you. Do you recall what happened to that individual? Was it sort of like a spontaneous recovery, as they call it?
Yes. He had complications following a brain surgery for a brain tumor, and he had cerebral hypertension. So the pressure in his skull, in his brain, was so extremely high that he said, well, this is incurable. But still, he regained consciousness after 3 weeks.
3 weeks and, only?
Yes. And what we know, I think, but you perhaps know yourself as well, that when people after coma regain consciousness and they have had an NDE, they are far better off than patients who regain consciousness out of coma without an NDE. The memory come back earlier, they can leave hospital earlier. It's striking, I think.
Now, do you find a difference in their intelligence and their consciousness as a result?
Well, that's very hard, because mostly we don't do any study before a coma or before a cardiac arrest.
Right, yeah.
So you cannot compare it. So there are always questions about, is there some psychological or physiological difference between patients who have an NDE and patients who don't have an NDE. So the problem is you never have studied patients before the cardiac arrest, before the coma, so there's no answer on it.
Mm. Well, yes, that makes total sense. I just was wondering if maybe there was, if you noticed a difference between the near-death experiences versus the non-NDEs, you know, what their behavior might be like and what have you.
Yeah, but what we did in our prospective study, where we studied 344 patients who survived cardiac arrest, that 18% reported an NDE, and 82% did not report an NDE. And when we compared those two groups, so the 18 and the 82%, there was no difference at all between the duration of cardiac arrest, the duration of unconsciousness for given medication, for the education, for religion, for pre-knowledge of NDE. So there was no difference at all between those two groups, except the age. When they were younger, they have more chance to have an NDE, to experience an NDE, and patients who had an NDE before reported more often an NDE. So there was no difference at all. And that was the reason that we wrote in our Lancet paper, our study was published in the Lancet in December 2001, mm-hmm. that we said there is no medical, no physiological, psychological, or pharmacological explanation why people experience an NDE. There's no explanation else. So it's still a mystery.
Yeah, and another thing, too, I wonder if out of those 82 people, if there may have been a chance that some of them did, in fact, have an NDE but didn't feel at liberty to acknowledge it or what have you. Do you think that there could have been a possibility of that?
Yes, there has been, because we interviewed all survivors of cardiac arrest with an NDE after 2 years, and we interviewed the same amount, let's say it's a matched control group of patients who survived a cardiac arrest without an NDE, and in those 237 patients who did not report an NDE, we found 4 patients who after 2 years seemed to have had an NDE, 2 with a superficial NDE and 2 with a score of more than 7. So there have been patients who were so reluctant to report or to talk about the NDE just in the first days following the cardiac arrest. And this is well known from literature as well.
Yes, yes.
But I think most people of the 82% did not report an NDE.
And I also tend to wonder if a lot of people are still concerned that they will be judged, you know, oh, you need psychiatric evaluation, because that is, in fact, what happened to me. And that caused me to actually shut down, and I refused to talk about it for over 20 years.
Yes, I think that when somebody is really open and interested and approaches you with a really honest question, and you have your enhanced intuition and you feel that he is honest, I think you will start talk about it.
Mm.
I think that at least is my experience, that I heard so often stories of NDE afterwards as well, because I was open and asking about it, and my colleagues, cardiologists, didn't hear any story at all.
Well, it's people like you and Dr. Peter Finnick, who was on the show a fortnight ago, have been such a tremendous source of inspiration for me. I can't tell you, because...
Oh, that's nice.
it's
that's
so important.
You.
It's really important that you know, people... I mean, you are making such tremendous strides in the medical community as well as in the global community, bringing all of this into the light, because and the big underlying issue of discussion here is the survival of consciousness after physical death.
Yes.
And I personally think that we are quite daft to think that the physical body and the physical brain is all there is to reality. I'm never going to agree with that. And I so appreciate how universally so many of us, independently of one another, have come up with the same illustrations and analogy about consciousness. And when I was reading your articles here, that I've got them both on my website, where you're actually describing the brain as being a receiver, like a radio or a television, and I said, blimey, that's exactly the same illustration that I've given, that The brain is not the broadcaster, it is the receiver of the broadcast.
It has not a producing function, but a facilitating function. So I call it the transceiver. It receives and it transcends as well. It tends as well. So because all the information from the body and from the senses comes into your consciousness as well. So it is a transceiver. And it has a facilitating function. And there is only a physical death.
Right.
But the consciousness has always been there and always will be there.
And now, is this something that you have written? I know that you've been working on a book, and you recently finished your book. Is that what your book is about?
Yes, but my book is entitled Endless Consciousness. And in my book, I describe first all the elements of the NDE, like the elements as Moody has described them as well, with samples of patients or persons I met personally to describe for people who never have heard anything about it, to know what aspects that can be possible. And then I describe all the theoretical models for explanation, and I describe why all those explanations are not valuable. They're not true. Then I describe my our Dutch study, and I describe what happens in the brain during cardiac arrest. And I have a chapter about what do we know of the function of the brain, because we don't know so much of it. It's just a lot of things we just don't know about the brain function. And then I come to my more theorist explanation, how we could understand the relationship between consciousness and the brain, and I use some quantum mechanical issues to explain it, like the non-locality of consciousness. I'll explain the role of DNA as well, because I think that the DNA is the real interface and not the brain by itself. But each cell has contact, non-local contact with consciousness by the DNA. And I also describe, then I come to the conclusion that our consciousness is non-local, and our waking consciousness as we experience each day is only a part of the enhanced or non-local consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I also describe in a chapter that nothing is new, that it has been said and written before in by Plato, by the Tibetans, by the Hinduism, the Upanishads, by in the Bible. So in Middle Ages, it has been written and said always during mankind. So nothing is new at all.
Exactly. This is tremendous. And I wanted to ask you also about the DNA, because there's been a lot of discussion and dialogue about DNA, especially what is it, the 5% DNA that's considered junk DNA. Or, sorry, not 5%, I'm reversing it, 95%.
5% is for the... It's just making all the... the English word. But 95%, it's called junk DNA.
Yes, that's what I was referring to. I reversed it by accident, but I meant to say that they refer to the 95% as
junk DNA, because we don't know the function. And the junk DNA has a kind of barcode functionality. It receives information, non-local information. And it's not only our consciousness, but also what you can call the morphogenetic information as well, what Rupert Sheldrake calls the morphogenetic fields. But it's received by that as well. And what you can call the unconscious aspects of our consciousness, we can receive as well by our digital DNA. This is just a theory. You cannot prove it yet, but I think you will have to look after it.
But also, it would appear that everything is lining up so beautifully that it seems quite apparent, I would think, that this is real. And I was going to ask you if you feel that the 95% of the DNA is actually functioning functioning multidimensionally.
So it's not local means that there is no location and no time, and everything is interconnected. Everything is one. This is the non-local dimension.
Yes. And during the near-death experience, that becomes so apparent. It certainly did with me, you know, and there's no question whatsoever that everything is one. And, you know, it's ineffable. It's very near impossible to describe something like that. But I really appreciate when someone like yourself can come forward and help explain this a little bit. And I wanted to ask you, because there's still so much controversy around, you know, some people will still insist that these experiences are connected with a dying brain and all that, what I call nonsense,
yeah.
Really. Can you explain why it is not the byproduct of a dying brain?
Yeah, well, there are so many arguments, and one of the arguments is that the conclusion of our study we did in patients who had a cardiac arrest, because there have been studies done what is happening in the brain during cardiac arrest, and it was done in animals, but also in patients who, in threshold testing during implantation of internal defibrillators, when you do an implantation of the ICDs, then you have to measure the threshold, and then you have to induce a cardiac arrest. And they did this induced cardiac arrest during with an EEG, this electrical activity of the brain.
Yeah.
And what they saw, and they did also the ultrasound of vessels in the brain. And you see when you do the ultrasound, the Doppler, you see the blood flow is zero within 1 or 2 seconds. And you see the clinical picture of a patient in cardiac arrest is the loss of all body reflexes.
Yes.
They are unconscious. And this is the activity of the cortex. And you also see the loss of all the brainstem reflexes. And you see the loss of the activity of the center for breathing. So the clinical picture is that they lose the activity of the brainstem and the cortex. You measure a zero flow blood to the brain. And the EEG, the electrical activity of the cortex, disappears into a flat line in an average of 15 seconds. So when you resuscitate a patient with a cardiac arrest at a coronary care unit, it is an average of 60 to 120 seconds. So we know by these kind of studies that all patients who are studied in prospective studies with cardiac arrest must have had a flatline EEG as well. So the brain was not functioning. And still they had an enhanced consciousness. So this is the reason to say, and they can also have the out-of-body experience, so they can have revival perceptions out and above the body, and you can objectify what patients tell that they have seen and what they have heard. And then you know the moment this happened as well. So it's impossible to have this from a dying brain.
Well, that's exactly what I have always felt too. So
but I always say also that everything I say and I tell is because all people with any were my teachers. They have told me, they have explained it to me, and I've just checked it by, let's say, the scientific way. But the NDEs are my teachers.
And the stories are also very consistent, and they never change over time.
No, that was also what we saw in our long-term study with interviews after 2 years in ages. The patients that were taped interviews, the patients used exactly the same words after 2 years and 8 years. So it was not a kind of trying to be interesting or trying to have some nice stories. They just are emotional. You feel that they're just trying to find words for an experience there are no words for, that you must know yourself as well. Always when you try to explain to others what you experienced during NDE, then you always have to say, but it was something different.
It's such a powerful experience as well.
Exactly.
And so when, you know, that's why I'm very excited about the fact that there's a lot more dialogue about this now, because I'm hoping that as people like yourself and Dr. Finnick continue to do more studies, and more and more people can feel safe to come forward and declare, all right, I've had a near-death experience, and that they're not going to be ridiculed or what have you, because it's very painful to go through that.
That's the story you always hear, and you have waited for 20 years before you started to talk about it.
I did.
That's awful. And I think that it's so important also, this program that you do, and you're writing about it and having websites about it, that you help patients and people to start talking themselves about it to others, because you can teach others how it really is. So you are the more important people. We just, the scientists, can help you.
Well, and again, you're doing such tremendous work because, you know, people still regard the medical establishment. They look to you for credibility and validation, which is very interesting. I tend to think that we're actually validating one another. It's a two-way street here, and it's very, very important. because when we do have these experiences, they so radically change us forever.
Yeah.
Not only our consciousness, and that's another interesting point, because people come back from the near-death experience very intelligent, very bright, very sharp. And I know, you know, from being in hospital more times than I care to admit, thank you, that... you know, a lot of people will say, well, when you've been in coma and when you've been damaged like this, there's irreversible brain damage and people are never going to be the same again. And yet, people come back more intelligent and more keen than they were prior to having had the near-death experience and being in coma and what have you. So I think that's a very interesting dynamic there.
I totally agree with you. And the problem is that most doctors and neurologists won't believe you, and they won't listen because it doesn't fit in their own paradigm.
Mm.
And so we have to change the paradigm, and we have to change science as well, because science until now has a just materialistic approach.
Yes.
And you cannot approach subjective experience with a materialistic science. So science has to change as well.
Are you seeing any changes in the medical community around this? Like, for example, any potential for more study being done about death and dying?
I don't think it's such important to have new studies again and again and again, because the studies that have been done by Peter Fennick, Bruce Grayson, and Sampania, and also Murray Borogar now, are enough to convince if you want to listen and to read. And I think, well, let's talk about the Netherlands, Holland. I've given lectures to most medical students in Holland. So I go to medical schools and give a lecture about NDE for 200-300 medical students.
Okay.
And so most young doctors now in Holland have heard about it. I don't think that they'll say that they will accept it, but they know something about it, and so they can start to be open for it. And you can never ask them to believe it. They have to do it themselves. So you have to touch their heart to be open. And they're mostly very emotional when you talk about this, and they're very intrigued about it when you talk about a non-functioning brain and still having an enhanced consciousness.
Yes.
So it's a slow progress, but I think it's progressing.
Well,
I'm an optimist. I'm positive.
I am too, and that's actually what I was hoping for, is that there would be more training in medical schools.
Yes.
Because it seems like, if I understand correctly, and mind you, I'm not a physician, nor am I a nurse, but I've been on the wrong side of the needle a lot myself. But I was just wondering about, medical training. And from what I understand, there's very little that is covered about dealing with death and dying. And also, on top of that, the near-death experience and consciousness. So I was just wondering what you were observing with regards to implementing more time and study into death and dying and the near-death experience.
Yes. Well, it's a very important issue, I think. It's such a taboo, not only in our society, but especially, I think, in the medical society as well.
Yes, and in the Western society.
In the Western society, of course, in the Western society. We're talking about the Western society, not about India. We're not talking about India at all. And I think that those scientific papers that we're talking about are important. And perhaps a book like what I'm writing now, that will be translated in English as well, can be helpful because it's scientific-based and a lot of references. And the references come from just well-established journals. And hardly any reference from, let's say, the parapsychological journals, etc. Because I think it's so important to show doctors and scientists that there is also in the well-known journals enough to see that it's something different than that we think or believe, I should say.
Well, I think it's really important to stretch everybody's minds right now because things certainly are not what they seem. And
oh, no.
A lot of people will start asking questions just about experiences that they have with their consciousness. And I'm not even talking about a near-death experience, but just different states of consciousness. And then they'll start to question themselves as being crazy or what have you, and then I tell them, no, you're not crazy in the least, because we are, in fact, multidimensional, and consciousness is way beyond what we perceive on the physical plane.
Oh, yeah, the physical plane is just our waking consciousness.
Yes.
And this is just a small aspect of our enhanced consciousness. So I totally agree. And also what I mentioned in my book, and also that even perhaps more taboo than the NDE is the posterior mortal and post-mortal experiences. So people who experience a person, an appearance of a person who is dying at a long distance.
Yes.
Or people who have contact with the consciousness of a deceased relative, which when the partner has died, it's about 50% of the people have contact with the consciousness of the deceased partner. And we have lost a child, then it's about 75% of the parents have contact after death with the consciousness of the deceased child. So these are enormous, impressive figures, but it is totally silent. Nobody is talking about it because it's taboo.
And also have this to taboo. Say, and my question is, why is it so taboo?
Because when you start to talk about it, people will start laughing at you.
Yeah.
They won't believe it until the moment they have experienced themselves. Such
exactly.
So it doesn't fit in the paradigm from Western society. And but again, I think it's changing as well. But it's slow progress. And what also is such a taboo is that what you will know better than anybody else is that enhanced intuitive sensibility following an NDE.
Yes.
It's something I always ask about because most people never start talking about it spontaneously without asking. Because they're so reluctant to talk about it as well because it's difficult to accept that you feel the pain and emotions of others, of you that you know that someone will die. And that's a lot of responsibility and a lot of problems for most people.
Well, I've got to admit, I experienced that myself, and I've always been very clairvoyant. And,
Before?
Well, actually, I had near-death experiences as a very small child as well.
Okay. Yeah, then you
know,
have been...
So both an adult and as a child, but every time the NDEs have validated and enhanced my intuition and my empathic abilities. And no, it's something I can't switch off. I'm burdened with it, although, I'm pleased to accept the burden because it feels like a real necessary and important service.
Exactly.
But again...
But it is sometimes very hard for people to experience this enhanced intuition.
You
cannot handle it. You can handle it, but a lot of people cannot handle it.
Well, it's definitely work, but again, you know, and I've explained this to people, especially some fundamentalist people, with their different religions, they'll try to say, oh, that's evil and that sort of thing. And I explain to them, this is nothing but consciousness, enhanced awareness. That is all it is. It's got nothing to do with magic. It's just simply being aware.
But what I always try to explain to people that there has been a functional change in the function of your DNA, so your reception ability has been enhanced by your NDE. So you not only receive your own personal consciousness, but you receive also, let's say, channel 1 is your personal consciousness, the channel 2, 3, or 4 are consciousness of others, which you receive as well.
Yes.
So your reception ability has been enhanced.
So have you been doing more research and study into the DNA? Because this is such a very interesting factor in all of this.
Yeah. But I've been writing it down now in my book also about children and NDE. And I have tried to put everything what is known until now together in one book. And most things that I'm talking about with you now, I have mentioned also that the non-local awareness, the remote viewing, teleportation, telekinesis, but also the mind over matter. But in the brain, which is important is the neuroplasticity, that the mind changes the function and anatomy of our brain. And there's so many studies about it. So it's mind over matter. And I think, so there's so many things put together now that people have to start reading and thinking about it. Everything is known already, and has been known already.
Mm.
But now we have to get more accepted by science, by the medical community, but also by society as well.
And I think a lot of it is about remembering what is real and what has always been intact. And this reminds me, too, about, discussing the NDA, DNA, there we go, Mercury is retrograde, and so is my tongue right now. I can't seem to get my words out right today. the DNA, now, there's also the aspect of the 90% of the brain that purportedly isn't used. Do you think that this might have something to do, again, with the interdimensionality of consciousness?
Can you put the question again?
The fact that we only use 10% of our brain.
Okay,
What would you say about the other 90%? Would that also be interdimensional, like the 95% of the DNA?
I think that we use more of the brain than the 5 or 10%. But we not use it at the same moment. Say, when you have a conscious experience, there are about 10 centers in the brain active, and especially that the brain needs integration and communication within the brain to experience consciousness. So the brain is a constant evolving, let's say, instrument which needs integration and differentiation and communication to experience consciousness. So I think a lot of aspects of the brain are active, but you cannot measure it.
Yes, that would be very interesting to decipher, especially when you're trying to figure out what's going on with the other roughly 90%, I would say. But it does seem to me again, when I think of the brain as being a receiver, you know, like you have also so beautifully put in your article that it is really the receiver, or you use the analogy of the television a bit as well, you know, that the picture isn't really coming from the television, it's coming through it. And so, you know, really trying to drive this home, as it were, to people that, that our consciousness and our being does live and exist outside of the confines of the physical body and the human brain, and that the human brain is just the facilitator of, or I guess a filter, so to speak.
Exactly. And that changes everything, how we look to patients, but also how you treat patients in coma, how you treat patients, dying patients in the dying process, or what you think about abortion or euthanasia, or our organ transplant. So we had so many impacts about ethical medical problems in this time.
And that's hugely important because I've mentioned numerous times the article that I wrote. It's entitled "The Dying Process from an Experiencer's Perspective," because I was really noting, you know, that people are still so ignorant about what is actually going on with the person as one is dying and you know, getting ready to transition. And Dr. Fenwick and I were also talking about the deathbed visions and deathbed phenomena, just what you were saying, you know, they do actually experience and have communion with loved ones who are on the other side, who are actually coming to collect them and help them transition.
Oh, yeah. I'm convinced about it now. And what deathbed visions is can have the same content as an NDE. The difference is that in a deathbed vision, you are at the same time in the other dimension, and in your waking consciousness as well, you can communicate about what is happening in the higher aspects of your consciousness. While in NDE, you are unconscious. So the deathbed vision is a very special moment that you have. At the same moment, the enhanced consciousness contact with the non-local consciousness, and you are also able to communicate with people around you.
And they're also very, very clear about what they are experiencing and conveying
it.
It's so radically different from an hallucination. You know,
totally. it's not a hard, at all. No, it's not at all. And that's what I also tried to explain in my book. All those things that has been suggested that it's an hallucination or just ketamine or whatever. Always try to explain that it can never be true, never.
Now, would you like to give a little example or explanation about the difference between these visions and a hallucination? What have you noticed is the difference in the patients that you've experienced?
An hallucination is experience something in your mind, but it is not happening around you. So experience as it is true, but it is not true at all. And it is a very private experience, and it has no common elements like an NDE. It never gives a transformation, and it especially happens in psychosis, in using some drugs, or where you have had an overdose of alcohol or so. So it is pathological circumstances. It has no elements, it is private, and it is, has nothing to, let's say, the perception during an out-of-body experience you can verify, because it's true what happened, but in hallucination it's never true.
Now, have you done anything where you've, in your studies of near-death experiences, have you created targets, as it were?
We had in our study in Holland, we had in one resuscitation room, we had a hidden target, but nobody saw it because people are resuscitated at home, in the street, in the ambulance, in the emergency room, in all rooms on the cryo care unit. So there was only a very small percentage of patients who were resuscitated in the resuscitation room in one hospital. And these patients didn't have an out-of-body experience with perception of this hidden target. So we tried it. We started in 88 with the hidden target, but we didn't have patients. No.
I thought unfortunately. I think it's kind of a curious study, but that there's different types of near-death experiences, obviously, and some people will actually hoover around their bodies and pay attention to what's going on with them. But then there are other people, like myself, who were not hoovering around their bodies. In fact, I went far and away during my NDE, and it was only when I was making the re-entry into my body that I actually became aware of it. And,
But when you get aware of the body, of what is going on, let's say, during surgery or during CPR, you are not interested in some hidden target, but you are interested in what's going on with this body and with the doctors and the nurses.
Yes.
So you're not interested in some hidden target at all.
Well, that's what I thought, and Dr. Fennett also pointed out that people are not going to be looking around the room, they are going to be looking at their body.
Or they're looking for their relatives somewhere else in a hospital or whatever, and they know what everybody's thinking and they feel the emotions. They're not interested in a hidden target.
Right. So that's a very good point, too, because, and how do we describe this? Oh, my. Our consciousness is so expanded during the near-death experience that it's not necessarily focused on one thing or one area, that we can see and experience different places simultaneously. Now, how people get their arms around that one, I don't know. But it's really true that we can be aware of and experiencing different places all at the same time.
Exactly. And this is what we call non-local.
Non-local,
okay. No location and no time. Everything is there at the same moment. And as soon as you have your attention to something, you will see or hear or feel it. But everything is there at the same time.
And it's very lucid and it's very real. And this is another sort of paradox, I guess, because I could feel things so deeply, and yet I did not have the sensation of a physical body or having any, you know, weariness or thirst or hunger or anything like that. But yet, I could still feel things so profoundly.
Yeah.
And again, that empathic element that comes into play where, and that really has never left me. Since then, I do have to shield myself, and there are exercises that I need to do in order to sort of protect myself, because it's almost like having a constant electrical shock, as it were. It impacts me so intensely.
Exactly.
And so
that's what I mean, that it's the problem to be so open. And even electrical problems you can have with your computer or your car or bulbs, whatever.
Oh yes, yeah. In fact, I've destroyed more computers without even meaning to, and I just thought, oh dear.
Yeah, there's also the physical aspect. There's so many things changed, and nobody will believe it until they see it themselves. Let me ask you, who was the first person who you were able to tell about your NDE? Was it a relative, or was it a doctor, or?
Well, and that's interesting because the first person I mentioned it to, there were a number of doctors on the case, and it was one male doctor that I mentioned it to, and straight away he was the one who said, I think you need psychiatric evaluation.
Okay.
So that shut me down, but then shortly after that, and this is really hard, I told a deaf friend of mine, who was a woman.
Yeah.
But she was Seventh-day Adventist, and they believe that when somebody dies, that's it. End of the story, they're just in the ground, and they're thoroughly dead, and there's no consciousness, and there's no being or anything. And so, you know, she insisted that I had an hallucination, so I shut down, and needless to say, we never spoke after that. I thought, I can't have somebody saying this to me. It devastated me.
Yeah, it's so hard for you because you had not believed in the most intense emotion you ever had.
You got that right, and that's exactly what happened to me. It was the most powerful experience, especially as an adult, having this transcendent experience, how it impacted me, and being a grown-up, then trying to talk about it and make sense of it, whereas when I was a child, it was just such a natural part of my being. It didn't bother me to talk about it. But then as an adult, to have my sanity questioned.
Exactly.
Oh, my God, I was devastated. So, indeed, I didn't say anything for a very, very, very long time. And I don't think it was until the mid-90s that I actually even heard of Raymond Moody or heard the term near-death experience. For some reason, I've been so sheltered. So that's why I feel very adamant about getting this information out there so people will not experience what I did, because I dare say it was devastating, and I still feel affected by that. Even today when somebody says, oh, no, that was a hallucination or whatever, and I just say, no, it definitely is not a hallucination. And so people like you are doing such tremendous work to help raise the awareness about this, because we need the scientific community now to validate somehow. It's like we need these people to say, yes, this is real, this is not hallucination. And for you, in your own language, in your medical language, as it were, to be able to explain why this is not a hallucination.
And it's so surprising that what you tell me is what I hear always. There are all those patients, either be in England or UK or Belgium or Holland or Germany or United States, everywhere in the Western world, people in their knee try to talk about it, have the same experience.
Yes.
They don't listen, they don't believe, they want to send you to the psychiatry. It's so incredible that such an intense experience cannot be shared with others. But again, I'm positive. I think it will change.
Well, I'm very positive about that, too, and I'm so grateful to be able to do this radio show, which is the first one about near-death experiences. And
oh, really?
Circulate, indeed, all over the world. And I wanted to ask you, when your book is coming out, and also when is the likelihood, if you know, when it will be published in English, because I certainly want a copy of it, too. When is it due out? When is it coming out, your book?
It's coming out in the 19th of November here in Holland.
Mm.
And my publisher was just in Frankfurt in the Buchmesse to talk about the translation to English, German, and French, and I haven't spoken to them yet. But I hope it will be translated in 2008. But I don't know yet. Just email me in another, let's say, 6 months, and I'm sure that I will know more about the date.
Oh, right. Well, you can certainly be assured that you will be hearing from me. I'm very, very excited about
this.
You're
welcome.
have you got any projects that you're working on that you would like to share with our listeners, or any research, anything coming up that you're working on?
No. I think what is the most important thing for me is just writing the book and lecture all over the world. Not only for science, but also for people with an NDE. Also in Germany, I was just in Berlin for 650 people, with more than 150 people with an NDE in the audience. So it's so important still to talk about it, to make people open, and that they can listen, and that they know that what they have experienced is true, and it happens all over the world.
Well, this is really, really wonderful, and again, I want to let our listeners know, I've been speaking to Dr. Pim van Lommel, and your articles are located on my website under Near Death Studies.
Yeah.
If you've got more articles, feel free to send them to me, and I will immediately put them on my website so people can read them, because they're so powerful. And feel free to send me the Dutch versions as well, because I do have an international audience, and I'm happy to put those on my website. I can't believe that our hour has already gone by. This has been tremendous, and I'm so pleased to have had you as our guest this week. And want to let everybody know you've been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source, and we've been talking to Dr. Pim van Ommel from the Netherlands, who's done extensive research and work on the consciousness, the near-death experience, deathbed visions, and the continuity of consciousness. This is really tremendous. I want to remind everyone that it is only with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. Next week, we are going to have as our special guest for a special two-hour show, Mr. David Icke, so you won't want to miss that. Pim, thank you very much once again for being with us. It's lovely, lovely having you. And blessings to you, blessings to everyone for listening this week, and we will talk to you next week. Signing off for now. Cheers.
Hi, welcome.
All right.